Welcome back to another episode of the Braun Body Health and Fitness Podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Maren Brannemann. Maren and I are going to be discussing end-stage ACL rehab, so considerations for return to sport, cutting, change of direction, and so much more. This is such an amazing episode covering a lot of things that I see missed in the majority of ACL rehabs. Maren is an absolute legend in this space, and I highly recommend you check out all she is doing on Instagram if you have not yet. To find her on Instagram, you can go to Maren, Maryn.dpt. This season is sponsored by ISOFIT, my go-to for all things isometric strength training. For more on ISOFIT, you can check the link below. Enjoy. Maren, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to work with you today. Thank you so much for being here and so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to our chat today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
For people who might not be familiar with you, or maybe they haven't seen all the incredible things you're doing down there in Dallas, would you mind filling them in a little bit about who you are and all that you do?
Yeah, so my name is Maren, and I am a sports physical therapist based out of Dallas, Texas. I have the pleasure of working with athletes pretty much across the spectrum, including the middle school, high school levels, all the way up to professional athletes in the NFL, NBA, MLB, mostly during their off seasons. As a former D1 athlete, I like to think I understand the multifaceted territory that is rehabbing from an injury. And that's definitely a big part of why I approach rehab, I guess I would say, a little differently than the average PT. I think when you're passionately like living in your purpose, it leads you to move with purpose and move on purpose in everything you do. And that's really what I try to bring to the table each day to set my athletes up for success. Because if I'm going to ask them to show up and give me their all, then I better be prepared to do the same.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I certainly agree that you're a little different than most PTs in the best way possible. I think anyone who hasn't seen your Instagram needs to stop and go check it out right now, because plain and simple, when most people hear PT, they think of hot pack, ultrasound, 3 sets of 10 straight leg raises on a table, 4 patients at a time. And you are not that at all. And that is the best thing possible. I think you are one of a very few select group of individuals that is reframing the way a lot of athletes look at and view physical therapy. And that's something I really respect about you. And, you know, you have that athletic background yourself. So I think that gives you a different way to relate to athletes that a lot of people can't. You mentioned that you were a D1 swimmer. Did you ever face any like injuries or setbacks when you were an athlete yourself, Mare?
Definitely. I had injuries pretty much throughout my swimming career. Had to get a knee surgery in college. I've definitely been in and out of the training room, worked with a ton of physical therapists. And so that really opened my eyes to the sports physical therapy realm and how to be able to influence positively those athletes to make them realize that when an injury like that happens, it can kind of feel like the end of their world, right? Sports are at the center of their world. It's everything they're trying to do, everything they're really focused on. And I think being able to show them that this isn't the end, this is just a reset, and being able to make that process more enjoyable throughout the way, because I think it is a huge mental battle as well. So I really try to make the environment that we're working in really dynamic. There's a lot of back and forth between patients. Like we try to make it more of a community and more of that like training room aspect vibe versus the typical PT clinic that you walk into, that you just have people on the tables doing their exercises and they come in, they get their stuff done, and then they leave. So we definitely try to make it a little more community-based.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And you mentioning you had, you know, a knee surgery in the past yourself, and it sounds like you kind of treat athletes very holistically and look at the very, you know, broader picture, for lack of a better way to put it. I think that's something that's absolutely essential for rehabbing an athlete following ACL injury. I think at this point, everyone's familiar with Google searching the outcomes and seeing that, you know, a lot of athletes struggle to get back. And it doesn't matter what level you're at, even in the NFL, I think the stat still holds true that about 1 in 3 don't come back. And there's different, you know, running backs and different names that come to mind for me about, you know, hey, they had a real complex knee injury and I don't see them in the league anymore. And it's very complicated to get back from that. But having the right person who's been through it before, who knows how to take you from day one to, you know, day 1000 or whatever that return to play process looks like is essential. For people who might not be familiar with like the ACL injury and how that occurs, would you mind just kind of walking them through how that occurs and what kind of factors go into the injury real quick?
Yeah, so there can be different aspects that lead to an ACL injury. There's contact versus non-contact injuries is how we kind of approach it as physical therapists. So a contact injury is more common in sports like football. So that is usually when an athlete, their leg is planted in the ground and then another athlete comes from the outside of their knee and forces it inside. So that's what we call like a valgus force. And then non-contact injuries, which are a little more common for ACL injuries, happen a lot of times with planting and change of direction. So when an athlete is trying to decelerate and then cutting, and so their knee ends up going into a quick valgus force again, and that is what puts that stress on the ACL and eventually causes the rupture. What the research is saying now is a lot of times it's not necessarily that one event. It's more of slight tearing over time. So especially with someone who has a non-contact injury, it's more of that neuromuscular pattern. So something that they've been doing over time. So it's not necessarily that one time that they planted and cut it on it, but it was the accumulation of all of the times that they've done it before.
Yeah, well. I love that. I love that you brought that up, the repetitive micro trauma side of things. I think it was Penn State University that just did a study on that, looking at like rabbits or something like that initially. But I think that there's a lot of merit to that. And there's a lot of different factors that go into the non-contact side of things, from what goes on at the foot and ankle to what goes on at the hip and at the knee itself, and even at the trunk and the core to a certain extent. And I think that, you know, a lot of PTs and strength coaches even are good at identifying those factors, but then it comes time to actually work them into training or rehab, and things kind of get lost in the shuffle somewhere. And, you know, it's funny, we talk about this a lot, where I think a lot of people can nail the first two phases of PT pretty well, pretty easily. But then when it comes time to transition that into something more meaningful and impactful, like the return to sports side or the end stage process of the ACL, that's an area where I see a lot of people really struggle. And, you know, I don't even know how we should go about defining what end stage ACL rehab is. Is that a certain timeline or a certain criterion? What do you typically define kind of like the end stage side of rehab to be for the athletes that you work with?
Yeah, so I definitely agree. And even as a physical therapist early in my career, I think end stage ACL rehab was really overwhelming, right? Because you're okay, you've been focusing on all the strengthening and everything that you need to build up muscle wise. But now it's how do we bridge that gap between that rehab and now the performance side of things? So looking at ACL rehab, for me, that end stage is what I would consider when we're initiating cutting and change of direction, because now we're getting into more of those sports specific movements. So even sports physical therapy, I'm always telling students that I have, it's really just orthopedics until you get to that end stage rehab. That's when sports rehab comes into play. And so for ACLs, the earliest that I'm going to initiate that would be around 5 months. And that is as long as they are meeting certain criteria that we set forth from the beginning. So I'm really clear with my criteria very early on. So even as early as day one eval, I'm going to go over with those patients okay, first I'm going to ask them, what has your surgeon discussed with you? Like, what do you understand about the rehab process, right? Because it's important for them to know and have appropriate expectations so that we're on the same page throughout the whole process. And I think that's also going to help motivation-wise when we're getting into the thick of things in that mid-stage rehab, when stuff can kind of get monotonous to, in a sense, to kind of keep them focused. So in terms of the end-stage rehab, before we get into the cutting, I'm going to break out the handheld dynamometer. And unfortunately, we don't have like an isokinetic machine, like a Biodex or something like that. That would be awesome if we did every now and then. I work with certain surgeons where they'll go back to the surgeon and do the Biodex testing with them. But if I'm just doing it in clinic, we have a handheld dynamometer that we use. I'm going to test quads, hamstrings, and then I'm going to look at like one rep knee extension max testing on the machine. We use like a Kaiser machine. And then I'm also going to put them through hop testing. So the requirements that I tell them are I'm looking for at least 90% limb symmetry. I know a lot of people think about that as their like end goal for return to sport. But if we're going to start getting into those cutting movements, really that is returning to sport. So I want that as soon as possible, but definitely by 5 months when we're going to be cutting. And then I'm also going to be looking at hamstring to quad ratio. So the norms for that are going to be anywhere from 50 to 80%. Obviously the closer to 100% that we can get it, the better, because then the hamstring is going to be able to provide some increased stability to the knee versus if it were a little bit weaker. But obviously your quad is still the big one for that. But those are the main thing. And with the hop testing, yes, I want it to be 90% limb symmetry, but I'm also more interested in how it looks. So obviously the research with hop testing kind of shows that there are a lot of different compensations and ways you can use other muscles besides just the quads in terms of still having good results with limb symmetry. So I want to look at, okay, what are their landing strategies? Are they dipping into any dynamic knee valgus when they're landing? Are they really relying on hip strategies, just throwing their hip back and they're not getting enough knee flexion? So just really looking into more functional testing a little bit too.
Yeah, I love that. Taking it beyond just looking at the numbers and actually looking at what the person in front of you is doing and even having conversations with that person as well. I think a lot of times athletes, especially the higher level ones, they've kind of known their body for such a long time that they will be able to look at you and tell you when something's not right. And the majority of the time when they say it, I've already seen it. But it's just nice to know that they can kind of confirm that. It's funny. I feel like my kind of, you know, return to sport test battery is almost identical to yours. The only thing I've added in recently is we have a vertical jump mat. And I really like the single leg vertical left versus right, because I feel like that forces a little bit more of a quad load than some of those hops do. But I completely echo your point on the importance of having some testing, the importance of gathering that objective info and matching what you see to what you get from a testing standpoint. So at that 5 to 6 month mark, roughly, you start to progress people back into what we call that return to sport progression. What exactly does that entail? What does, you know, sport activity look like, you know, from your eyes? You're starting with like sprinting, or are we starting with deceleration, or is that already checked at this point and we're just going into change of direction work? Where do we kind of start at that 5 to 6 month mark?
For me, I'm going to have already gotten my athletes into some return to sprinting. They won't have completed it yet, but they'll be on their return to sprinting program. So as long as they began their return to run at 3 months and they had no issues with that, they'll be into their return to sprinting around that 4 month mark. And so they should be a good bit through that by the 6 month or 5 or 6 month mark. So they'll have already started the sprinting, which means we've already also started a little bit of deceleration, right? Because you want to work deceleration before you work on acceleration. You want to make sure that the athlete is able to slow down prior to introducing those high level forces. So we'll work a little more on the deceleration. We'll continue to build from it, right? So making sure that we're emphasizing loading that penultimate step versus the ultimate step, making sure they're comfortable with tibial inclination, getting that knee forwards, and really being able to load your quad in those positions, even just being able to feel your quad working in those positions, because sometimes athletes didn't have appropriate strategies, and that's what contributed to their ACL tear. So it's almost like relearning how to do some things. And I think that's a really important aspect of it too, because now they've had so much time off of it that they haven't been doing these activities. So it's the perfect time to kind of reintroduce some new mechanics that are going to be a little bit more beneficial for them. So deceleration before acceleration. And then in terms of change direction, we're going to start in the sagittal plane. So just moving forward and backward. So it'll be like a jog to a back pedal, build up to a sprint to a back pedal. Then we're going to work into the frontal plane. So I like to initiate frontal plane with agility ladders. I think that's a great way for them to initially feel really subtle frontal plane forces without it being a ton of load on the knee. So that's kind of my, it's kind of my way of like putting it through a little bit of a test, right? So when you're beginning those stages, you're not doing those activities for conditioning. You're doing it as a way to load the knee and for the knee to get used to those types of forces again. So it's a knee joint loading progression, right? It's not for conditioning. So from the agility ladder, we'll kind of progress into really focusing on the mechanics side of things. So I'm going to emphasize that loading into the penultimate step with side shuffling. There's a couple of different ways that I do that. Sometimes it's with some Viper work. Sometimes it's just with agility ladders, agility squares for like more of a visual cue with their side to side movement. But that snap and go, so making sure that we're loading that penultimate step, the torso is in the direction of the way that they want to go. They're not leading too much off of the leg that they're planting on, right? So it's decelerating on the second to last leg, and then it's pushing off to accelerate on the last leg. And then after they've progressed into frontal plane, then we'll go back and we'll put the sagittal plane with the frontal plane. So then we're going to go like a forward jog or a sprint into a side shuffle side to side and then into a back pedal. And then from there, as long as that looks good, we're going to progress into the transverse plane. So then we'll get into more rotational movements, higher degrees of cutting. We're going to start non-reactive with everything in more of a closed environment. And then we're going to progress into reactive. We'll start reactive closed environment, and then we'll add reactive open environment. So that could be anything from including like a neurocognitive dual task or something like that.
Yeah, I love that breakdown that you just gave, Mayor. And I like the progression too, from starting with deceleration to acceleration and starting with, you know, straight line sagittal plane type activities and then progressing towards more involved planes of movement or combinations of planes of movement, I'll say. I love your point about the ladders too. I know that the speed ladders get a lot of hate, but I've been using them more and more with my mid to late stage ACLs over the past, I would say, 3 to 6 months. And I really like the ability to work repetitive contact over and over and over again. Like, you know, it's great that they can get good mechanics when I watch them once or twice, but I want that repeated over thousands and thousands of contacts. And that's really what we're looking for here. As you mentioned, is it's not enough to just have good mechanics on a few reps. It's, we want everything to look good and feel good for, you know, thousands of repetitions. So hopefully when we wrap up with this athlete, we never see them again for the same injury. So I love the incorporation of the ladders there. And I like, again, your progression from D cell to A cell, and then through the different planes that way. As far as the training that goes along with that, because obviously the field stuff and the change of direction is great, but we usually often incorporate a little bit of strengthening as well. How do you go about structuring the strength component of your sessions to the field component of the sessions, or the speed component of your sessions, I'll say? How do you kind of use the weight room to complement what you're doing with an athlete from their return to sport progression?
So it definitely depends where they're at with the progression. A lot of times early on, so when we're first introducing, say, the frontal plane movement, so we're first introducing that lateral shuffle, I'm going to incorporate the strengthening within a circuit with the side shuffle. So I'll use like a side shuffle with a Cossack squat. So they're getting that lateral shift. They're feeling that motion. We're making sure that their hip is getting loaded over their knee, which is getting loaded over their foot, so they can really feel that. And then we'll go into, I use like a Viper loaded side shuffle where they're going to do the same thing just with the Viper. And so that is, like you said, that repetitive motion. So really just getting reps and reps and reps. So it's, we're using just the movement itself to feel the movement out. And then we're going to load it in a similar pattern. And then we're going to put it back in motion with a lighter load where they're still forced to feel more of that. So even though they're not moving at a high speed initially, they're able to still feel a significant load through that position where they're going to be more comfortable when it comes to time to add the speed component to it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that point. And taking that a step further as well, on the change of direction piece, I think that that trunk lean and pelvic position, for lack of a better way to put it, is really essential. And I think that's something that, again, it's often overlooked, but I think it can be trained with proper exercises to kind of support things from a strength standpoint. Is there anything that you like to do to kind of hit varied trunk lean positions and that sort of thing from a strength perspective?
It definitely depends on the athlete. I will say a lot of the athletes, when we get to this phase of rehab, they're like, wow, I was never taught that before. Or why didn't anybody teach me this? It feels so much better. Because once we get into the speed component, they're like, wow, I feel so much faster this way. Because it is just biomechanically more efficient for them, right? So I think the trunk lean comes a lot more. I don't necessarily train the actual trunk lean, but earlier in the rehab phases, when we're in that mid stage, I'm going to make sure that I'm still hitting core strength. I'm still hitting adductor strength, right? Because your adductor is going to contribute to that pelvic stability. So even though we're focusing on, say, the quads, the really getting the quad back, everyone loves the quads, and maybe I'll get a little bit of hate for this, but I think it's really making sure you're still being holistic in your approach, because you have to think of how long that athlete was out of strength training in the beginning, just getting back to their daily activities. So you still have to build up the other muscles that are going to be contributing to those high level forces, even though we might focus more on the quads in our sessions in those mid-stage rehab. Like I said, we're still going to be hitting core. We're still going to be hitting adductors. We're still going to be hitting glutes. I think that is kind of the key to make sure that you don't get to that point of rehab when you want to get them cutting, and then you realize, oh, well, they're not able to get into that trunk lean position because their obliques aren't strong enough. And it's not necessarily going to always be something that I'm going to program into my sessions, but it's going to be something that I'm going to make sure they're working on outside of physical therapy as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I love that. I mean, ultimately, if you get to the 6, 7, 8 month mark and you start to get into some of these late stage progressions and you haven't even mastered like base abduction, adduction strength or base core strength, then you certainly missed a mark in your rehab, I'll say. And I like your point too about how you don't have to do all of those things with the athlete when they're with you in PT. You can give a lot of them at home. And I mean, you can start this stuff real early. Like, I have a program I've started to give a lot of my athletes where we're basically crushing core within the first month. Once they master the straight leg raise, we do a lot of different positions that are basically a straight leg raise ISO, right? Your hollow holds and that sort of thing. And we can get that core strength back very early on. And it just makes the late stage process so much easier for us. You also mentioned when you were talking about your initial progression earlier about the incorporation of reactive elements into your rehab. And I think that's something that's also commonly missed. And I think that's something that shows up in the literature time and time again as being one of the things that actually like plays into the initial injury itself, is the athlete is often, reacting to a stimulus on the field. And again, I think that's often missed. How do you go about progressing the reaction component of, you know, speed, change direction? What does level one versus like level 100 look like for you as far as reactive training elements go?
For reactive drills, it's going to be layered, right? So in the beginning, reactive might just be two different directions, me pointing right versus left. A lot of times for reactive components, I love using visual cues because in sport, that's how they're going to receive it, is visually, and that's how they're going to need to interpret that stimulus in order to react. So a lot of times, whether it is through like pointing or using lights or whatever, like blaze pods, like it's going to be through visual feedback. So it'll start just with like one or two directions. Then we'll add in, so say we're just starting in the frontal plane, then I might combine like a frontal with a transverse plane. And then it can also be like within a movement. So say it's a like cornerback in football, like a DB or something, and they're backpedaling. I'm going to point one way and then I'm going to make them point another way. So it's like multiple cuts within one movement, versus just giving them like, okay, you're going to run towards me and then I'm going to point one way and I'll point the other way. So it's like layering it, if that makes sense.
So it sounds like essentially what you're saying is you start with very basic visual commands, such as left versus right, and then you layer it by adding in other elements, such as multiple directional changes back and forth. So, you know, left, right, left, instead of just left or right, and then adding a further element to it with the incorporation of, you mentioned blaze pods and other light reactive type training devices that way. I mean, that's a fairly dynamic way to, you know, closely mirror what we do on the field or as close as we can. And you can even progress that in duration. You can progress the number of contacts. You can add like other distractor type elements to it as well. I think that there's a lot of other ways to progress it, but it sounds like you basically start from just general visual left versus right, and they know which one it's going to be, you know, very organized, very structured, up to like a more random kind of style.
Yeah. So we'll start just simple left or right. And then we'll have multiple points within the left or right. So it'll be like straight to the side, diagonal forwards, diagonal back, and then that on both sides. So we'll progress adding in those different directions. We'll use the blaze pods. We can add in, if I have like two athletes in the same stage of rehab, I like to get them together and get a little bit of camaraderie in that too. And so I can have them reacting, like facing each other and reacting, doing the opposite. So say that one person is going to be the attack, like offensive player, and the other person will be the defensive player. And so that defensive player is going to try to mirror whatever the offensive player does, and then they'll switch. So I think that's another way to get a reactive component that is going to be more sports specific, trying to like beat each other to this one spot that is determined by the player or athlete that is the designated offense. So I think those are the main ways that we'll progress through that. Obviously, there's additional like neurocognitive components where we'll add math into it. So I'll say, okay, to your right is going to be even, to your left is going to be odds. And then I'll give them, say I give them two numbers that they have to add together, and whatever those numbers equal, they have to go to the correct cone from that. And so while they're, it'll be them running in a certain direction while they have to complete that mathematic problem in order to then progress to the appropriate cone. So even though that sounds really complicated, that is in a sense what is happening when they're in sport. They're having to survey the field in front of them, determine what stimulus is coming at them in what direction, and what's the appropriate way for them to go based on that. So
yeah, definitely. They have to be aware of space on the field, you know, where it is, where it isn't, their teammates, their opponents, and the position of, in most sports, the ball that's being used. So it's certainly a lot to think about. And I like the incorporation of, you know, cognitive puzzles or brain games or whatever that way into that progression, because you want them to not be thinking about how they move. You want it to be like a subconscious, this is how they move without thinking about it. You know, if they're this late in the game and they still have to think about every step they take, then clearly that's probably telling me that they're not confident and they're probably not at that like return to sport level that I want them to be at yet. So I love the incorporation of all of those things into, you know, adding in the reactive elements into rehab. You also mentioned that you like to, you know, pair people up and kind of have like a little bit of competition almost, you know, as long as things work out from like a rehab standpoint, as far as like same stage athlete, that sort of thing. Do you do something similar when you initiate like return to contact as well?
The way that I approach return to contact is a little differently. I like to consider the forces that the athlete is going to be facing within their sport and recreate them in a different sense. So I'm not necessarily going to be trying to recreate an athlete cutting while I'm providing contact to them, or having two athletes provide contact to each other. I think in terms of the rehab setting, I found it more beneficial if we're breaking down those components. So providing a stimulus that is either like perturbating them, or providing something that is throwing them off their center of mass where they're having to react to it in that sense, but not necessarily in the same exact way that they would be doing their sport. Because I think that if I'm confident enough to put them through that in my clinic, that means I'm confident in their biomechanics and the way that everything looks. And so from that sense, I'm going to be trying to get them to do that on the field on their time. So my goal is really, and maybe this is the athlete in me, but really to try to get them back to their team as soon as possible. So especially with non-contact things, as long as I've seen them do it, they look good, I'm letting them do that with their team, even if it's something as simple as a passing drill or a shooting drill, just so they get that sense of being back with their team, because that's huge for their mental health. And it also helps like bring them back to life a little bit for the end of their rehab, get them going a little bit more. So I found that I can recreate the forces that they're going to go through with getting back to contact, maybe not the same exact forces, like not the same intensity of the forces, but very similar to that, that I don't need to be trying to say like take a stability ball and like chase them around the room, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And it's so funny you bring that up, because I think sometimes people get carried away with that in rehab, and it just ends up looking a little goofy. Like, You know, I've done it before to a limited extent where, like, if I'm like on the fence, like, is this person ready or not? Or maybe to your point about the mental side, maybe they have a little hesitation and they just want to get the first contacts out of the way in a more controlled one-on-one setting, as opposed to when they're out on the field for the first time surrounded by 10, 11 players. Or, you know, if they're a high school athlete, maybe the first time they're back is tryouts and there's a little extra pressure. So I certainly think there's a time and a place for it, but it's not every single session. It's not every time. To your point, our goal is to get people back at sport. You know, I think Kenny Powers said it best. Our goal is to get people playing real sports and not be the best at exercising. You know, plain and simple, we could keep people in PT indefinitely and, you know, they would probably not, hopefully not re-injure their ACL in PT. But that's not what they're there for. They're there to get back to sport. And I think that's where, you know, the more, I'll call it the locus of control comes in as well, right? You're actually giving the patient control over the things that they can do for once, instead of constantly having them being told, no, you can't do this. No, you have to wait to do this again. No, we're not at this stage yet. You're actually giving power back to the athlete instead of further restricting them at this, you know, late stage in the game. And if you're 8 or 9 months in the process and you're still, you know, not at that locus of control standpoint where you're finally getting the reins back to yourself, it's certainly very frustrating and challenging from a mental standpoint.
Like you said, there's definitely a time and a place for it where you can use it. And also when I am getting an athlete back to contact in practice, it's going to be in more of a controlled environment. So we're always going to start out with them doing more simple drills where they're comfortable. I'm going to give them a certain amount of reps that they're going to be allowed to do. I'm going to emphasize that first time you should walk away feeling like you could have done more. We want you to stay in a good spot versus like doing too much, making your knee blow up and get irritated and then setting us back a little bit. Cause it is still, even when they first get into contact with their team or in their sport, it is still a knee loading progression, right? So I'm going to give them parameters for that activity. And like I said, it's not going to be the first time that they're going to do contact is in an uncontrolled environment, or more so, it's not going to be in a high pressure or in a game situation.
Yeah, right. Progressing them back. And I think this is an area where the collaboration piece is so important as well, right? Like, I think the days of being the outlaw physical therapist are far, far over. You know, you can't do this full progression yourself. I don't care if you're working with a college athlete, a pro athlete, like, you need to incorporate the skills coaches, the team coaches, the strength coaches, the ATs. It really takes a village to help with some of these end stage progressions. And I think that's an area too, where, like, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not the most knowledgeable about every single sport. Like, I rehab a lot of lacrosse athletes. I've never played lacrosse before in my life. So when they get to that standpoint, instead of doing a ton of lacrosse drills myself, when, again, I don't know everything, I kind of like to work with their coaches on that and talk about what they can kind of progress back into from a practice standpoint. So again, to your point before about getting them involved back with the team, but also getting them involved with someone who might know a little bit more than I know about certain things.
I totally agree and commend you for that, because I think it's easy as physical therapists to get in our ego a little bit and be like, well, I have this degree, and so now I'm supposed to be able to know all of these things, when really you're not meant to know all of that, but you're meant to know where to get those answers. So you're meant to have resources in order to set your athletes up for success in that way. And I'm really blessed in a sense, the performance center that I work out of, I work closely with a few of the trainers there and different skill coaches that are able to provide that for the athletes. And we have great relationships where we're able to communicate on a daily basis about them and how they're performing and what are some things. They'll give me feedback on things that I could be working on. and I can provide them some feedback on, okay, we started doing this, they were looking pretty good, I think he's ready for you to start incorporating those things into your sessions now, let me know how they're looking. So it's a lot of back and forth and communication, like you said, that takes a village. I think we do our athletes a disservice when we try to just take it all on ourselves.
Yeah, 100% agree. And, you know, that's an area, again, I see PTs and strength coaches and, you know, a lot of individuals making the mistake of not being willing to collaborate with other people's or trying to do everything themselves. And as we've talked about so far, like the mistake of not having a plan for progression back to the field and, you know, helping the person in front of you get back to what they want to do. Do you see any other mistakes or common pitfalls made by individuals working with like the late stage ACL crowd?
I think we touched on a couple of them already. Early in my career, I would say I thought that I had to like totally recreate their sport in clinic before I felt comfortable enough for to send them out into doing their sport without me watching it, right? But like I said, I've come to realize that there's other ways that I can recreate those forces and make sure that they're biomechanically sound and strength-wise sound, mobility-wise sound, all of that in order to be confident in their abilities. I think it also comes from recognizing that we're trying to develop three-dimensional athletes, right? So if we get too stuck, I think there's a couple of different mindsets of physical therapists. We get the rep of being chronically underloading patients. Then we have physical therapists who are just trying to be strength coaches, right? But I think recognizing that we're trying to build three-dimensional athletes. So yes, you can have them on a barbell. You can have them doing heavy double leg loading. You can have them doing any kind of lift that you want, but really recognizing your end goal early on is going to help you in order to plan throughout the process, because it can get overwhelming. Because I think the tricky thing with ACL rehab is every patient presents so differently. Because even when I've had athletes that are in the same stage, even a couple of days apart is when they had surgery, they present so differently throughout their stages of rehab. One will excel in the early stage, one will excel in the middle stage. I think it's important to keep that end goal in mind in order to know where you're trying to lead them, in order to know, okay, if I want to get them back to playing football, they need to be able to do all of these things. So when we get into cutting, they need to be able to have power through the transverse plane. They need to be able to have strength single leg so that they can produce adequate force through the ground in order to accelerate or decelerate. So it's a matter of not getting too hung up on one part of the rehab, I guess I would say, and knowing that nothing is ever going to run perfectly, right? So we're dealing with people. And so you might have this perfect layout with all of these different phases and all these progressions that you want to go through, but someone might not need a certain progression. They might be able to go from level 1 to level 25, and then they might get hung up on level 30 or something like that on their way to level 100, right? So it's not going to look the same for everyone, and that's okay.
Yeah, no, exactly. I love that point on individualization. And I also like the point that you bring up on, you know, you have some PTs who are accused of chronically underloading and others that are literally just being like strength coaches and trying to up, you know, their one rep maxes. And they've kind of forgotten about the whole sport side of what we do. And I think ultimately everything kind of exists on a continuum. So there's times when, you know, there might be a session or two when PTs would look at me and say, wow, he didn't load that person enough. But then you kind of take the context into account, and maybe that person was having a rough day and they were on 4 hours of sleep and they've got a big exam later, and I'm just trying to get whatever I can get from them. So yeah, maybe I did underload them that day, but maybe that's what that person needed the most at that point. And then there's other times when maybe I loaded this patient or client I'm working with a little too much, but they came in cracked up on two energy drinks and they took over the aux, and now we've got heavy metal blasting and that's what we're going to do today. So ultimately it comes back to, you know, providing best for the person in front of you, as you said. And sometimes that looks like involves going off of what you might have had planned for that given day based on how they present. But that's the people element of this. And that's the biopsychosocial piece as well here is, you know, ultimately this being such a long, grueling process, even when you get back to these end stage things, it's normal for people to have a little bit of hesitancy or, you know, a little apprehension when they do things for the first time, because it's been 6-7 months since they last did it. And they went through some major things, you know, to get to this point. So I see that as being normal. And if me kind of going off plan slightly to provide them a better session and still progress forward is what I have to do, then I'm going to make that trade, you know, 99% of the time. So I love that point. And
I definitely agree with all of that. I think, like I said, just recognizing that our clients are humans, and what they're able to give one day might not be what they're able to give the other day. And adjusting your plan is really important in order to maximize your time, for one, because we get such limited time with them, such limited time where we're able to actually have eyes on them and see exactly what they're doing. So time is really valuable. But also just keeping in mind that this is someone who has been working so hard for a goal for so long. And so that gets tiresome, and that can weigh on you a little bit. And so different days, they're going to need different things. And I think that's another reason why I try to provide an environment where it's something they're looking forward to, right? So we're going to have high energy. We're going to be doing something enjoyable. We're going to be cracking up. We're going to be making it fun, making it something they're able to look forward to. Don't get me wrong. We're going to put in the work for sure. We're going to get a good sweat in. But at the end of the day, like I said, like these athletes are people too. And so, like you said, the biopsychosocial model is huge in order to consider throughout the process, because it is a big part of it, because ACL rehab can be so long and grueling for an athlete.
Completely agree. And I remember what I was going to say earlier. The other thing that you mentioned that I really like is the importance of understanding the needs that go into all of these different activities, like a needs analysis. So, and a lot of athletes or a lot of PTs do that to a certain extent, but taking it further and considering what goes into slowing down, what goes into change direction, and really diving deep in those things, and then relating them back to the sport demands, and maybe even a step further, the position demands that they have to, you know, complete on the field. And some people are going to make the argument that you don't have to do that, or you don't need the, you know, highly specific elements. But I can tell you right now, from my limited experience, people feel a lot more comfortable and confident when they go back to sport, feeling like they've already done the thing that you're trying to get them back to, in different ways, in different environments. If you can find a way to make it more challenging to them, maybe that's just them perceiving it as more challenging than what they're actually going to do on the field, then mentally, I feel like that's a huge box checked for the athlete. And as a clinician, understanding that it's okay to not have all the answers to those things. Like I said before, I don't know everything. I am very rarely the smartest person in the room. And I'm asking questions to a lot of people every single week. And I think that's what we have to do in order to best serve the person in front of us, right? Like, we can't just assume we know everything, and we can't just assume we have all the answers. Like, we have to double check and triple check our work as we go to make sure that we don't miss anything. Because as we mentioned time and time again, the most important piece of this is we're working with people. And it's not just return to sport for, you know, another ACL. It's like this person that we're working with and really trying to like humanize that return to sport process, for lack of a better way to put it.
I agree. And I also think, on top of what you were saying about not being afraid to ask questions, like, I've asked the athlete before, if I don't know something specific about their position, like, it's also okay to ask them something about the way something feels, or how do you do this part of your position. That's also, I guess, a benefit for me of working with elite level athletes, is they really know their bodies. And so they're able to kind of explain those things a little bit more. But I'm not above trying to understand their position. And even asking them, say we're working on some specific movement or movement pattern that they're going to have to do, asking them after they did it, okay, how'd that feel? What feels different about it when you do it on your non-op side? Like, is there the same amount of comfort? Is there the same amount of confidence with it? How can we get you to feel as confident on your op side versus your non-op side now? Like, what is the difference, and how do we bridge that gap? I think is a big thing that you can also have that communication with your athlete, because I think that also opens up the floor for them, because they feel like they're able to communicate more with you and you have more of an understanding, right? Because at the end of the day, they know their body better than we do. And so I think that's also a really useful piece of information that a lot of people miss out on, because we don't want to look like we don't know, right? We think that in order for them to trust us, like you said, we have to have all the answers, but that's not true. And frankly, in the field of physical therapy, like, everything is changing all the time. We're coming out with new research and all of that. And so we're never going to have all the answers. And I think coming to peace with that and knowing that the more questions you ask, the better. It's only going to make you better.
Like, yeah,
better, better for your patients, better as a clinician, better as a person. And for me, it's also fun. Like, when I get to work and get more specific into those positional drills, like, I love learning still. And so if I'm able to learn something new, and then I can come up with a new set of exercises or a new way to recreate the same forces, that's also fun for me.
You mean they don't teach all that in the textbook, really? It's amazing how much you can learn from just talking with your athletes on what they're going to be doing. And I think that's such an essential element as well, for the fact that, as you mentioned, every athlete is different. So yeah, I might have two guys that I'm rehabbing who are quarterbacks, but they might have very different playing styles, right? Like, one guy admits that he's extremely slow and he runs like a 5.140, and the other guy, he just likes to just kind of become more of a running back than a quarterback sometimes. So naturally, like, I have to take into account their difference in playing styles in the rehab, or, you know, I don't have to, but I'm going to. So I certainly echo that point on, you know, making those conversations, making those connections with your patients, and really diving into that side of the return to sport element. Because again, I think these are areas that most people aren't looking, but they say that, you know, 80% of your results come from 20% of your work. And I think this is the 20% of the effort that gives the 80% of the results, in my opinion. As we start to wrap up today, I feel like we covered a lot of ground as it relates to return to sport for the athlete following ACL injury. Is there anything that we missed, or any kind of closing thoughts or remarks that you have?
But I think that also just goes to say that ACL rehab can be a lot, right? it can be overwhelming for the clinician at times. It can be overwhelming for the athlete at times. And I think just going into it with a plan, knowing that it's okay to change the plan, knowing that you're not going to be perfect with everything, not every day, not every session, not every set is going to go the way that you hoped it would go. But just being adaptable and being able to tailor everything back towards your athlete, keeping them at the center of the plan, the center of every session, is really going to be what helps lead to more successful outcomes. It might not change necessarily your LSI, right? But it's going to make more of an impact on that athlete. And that, to me, is way more important than just trying to whip out results, right? Like, I'm still going to get the results I want, but I'm not just trying to line ACLs up on an assembly line, right? That's not why I got into physical therapy. I think as clinicians, as physical therapists, we have a really unique position in the medical field to actually interact with the athletes and actually form relationships with them and actually help them in a way that they might not get from quick interactions with their surgeons, right? So I think building trust early on and continuing to communicate throughout the process is really the biggest thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love those points. And I love everything that you've kind of shared today, from the more, you know, drill side and progression side, all the way up to the importance of humanizing sport and return to sport for the people that we serve day in and day out. For people who want to find out more about you, Maren, where can they find you at? Are you an Instagram or a Twitter or a Facebook or all of the above? Or
mostly Instagram. So you can follow me at Maren, MAIRYN.DPT. That's where I put most of my content.
Awesome. We will link to that in the description below. So that way, if you didn't quite catch that, you can just click there and check out everything that Maren is up to. I really appreciate your time today, Maren, and everything that you shared with us. This was an amazing discussion. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.